Welcome to Byline. I'm Rick Heldick. Well, after months of negotiations, the University of Louisville, its healthcare entities, and Kentucky One Health have agreed to a healthcare partnership. A merger of the public and Catholic-led entities proposed last year was denied by Governor Steve Beshear amid concerns about, among other things, the availability of reproductive health services. This is a partnership now instead of a merger this time, and the governor has approved it. It also has the endorsement of Attorney General Jack Conway. And joining us to talk about how all this will work is Dr. David Dunn, Vice President for Health Affairs at the University of Louisville. Dr. Dunn, welcome to Byline.
Rick, thank you very much. Appreciate being here.
Also here, WFPL's Devin Katayama, who's been covering the story. And Devin, I'll turn it over to you.
Thanks, Rick. I just want to quickly just go over some of the details of this partnership, this joint agreement that you have signed off on with Kentucky One Health, $1.4 billion 20-year contract. A lot of that money is coming in the first few years. Can you explain a little bit about what that money is going to be going to?
Well, first, let me just mention, Devin, that the genesis of this joint operating agreement that, as you point out, or as Rick pointed out, that the governor and the AG have signed off on, the governor signs it, AG approves, is that it became increasingly clear over the last several years that University Medical Center could not survive on its own. It's a small urban teaching hospital. And it's inextricably linked with the Health Science Center. And so as our fortunes rise and fall at UMC, same thing for the Health Science Center. So we embarked on a RFP process, a request for proposals. We sought a health system partner, and we found a great one in Kentucky One Health.
And now millions of dollars will be going to research and be going to improved technology. And then actually a lot of money is actually going to the Center for Women and Infants. Is that correct as well?
Yeah, there's several pools of funds, and the majority of the money is actually coming in for faculty support. It will enhance our ability to recruit new faculty and retain the best and brightest faculty. There are other pools of funds designated specifically for the Center for Women and Infants. There's a $17 million pool that will be withheld from UMC's balance sheet prior to close, and an additional $15 million. And the latter is really going to go to upgrades to make that a state-of-the-art center. Last time it was upgraded was 10 years ago.
Now, I remember in the press conference earlier this week, you said, or somebody was speaking about the joint agreement. They said some of this money is going to be depending on goals that are met. Can you explain a little bit about what those goals look like?
Sure. That's absolutely right. There are what are called contract finances, and that's money that's fixed in place over the 20-year period. There's about $75 million a year. For the first 5 years, and that is for support of academic functions such as clinical medical directorships, call, taking care of patients at UMC by University of Louisville faculty. And then there's also money that is contingent upon us achieving statewide initiatives, such as getting our clinical trial network out to the state, doing a whole bunch of things across the entire Kentucky One Health platform across the Commonwealth, quality measures, for example. Now, we've not completely agreed on exactly what those are going to be, but we will be doing so in the near future.
Now, at least on the surface, it seems like a lot of the things that were controversial during the merger talks have been addressed in this fact sheet that you have here with a lot of the questions that were posed during those talks are either not applicable anymore or they've been addressed. What's different this time around? What was the most difficult thing to negotiate this time around?
Well, in answer to your first question, what's different this time around? This is not a merger. And we heard what the governor and the attorney general and the public told us loud and clear. And so where before this public asset, University Medical Center, was going to be merged into another entity, Kentucky One Health, it's not being merged now. And so the assets remain with the University Medical Center and with the state. And because it's not a merger, we also are able to do a number of things that we could not have under a merger option. First and foremost, we were told there can't be diminished services, clinical services at UMC. And so all services that are in place today will be there tomorrow and after the joint operating agreement is implemented. And secondly, we will maintain the same level of indigent care that we provide today going forward. Thirdly, the academic programs are heavily supported, as we've already discussed. And then fourth, if we look at accreditation issues, there are safeguards built in to the academic affiliation agreement to ensure that all our programs, in particular the medical school with its undergraduate programs and its graduate programs, remain accredited for the 20-year period.
Now, one of the major controversies in the merger talks last year was the idea that Kentucky One Health, which was the entity that eventually became out of the failed merger between University Hospital, was it basically going to be infused, or at least Catholic Health Initiatives was going to have a major say in the decisions made. How has that changed? It sounds like now University Medical Center will remain completely independent, but will there be any instances at all where there's going to be decisions made by CHI that could affect the services or could affect the employees working at these University Hospital?
Well, what we did from the onset of the RFP process was to tell any potential bidders what the parameters were. And first and foremost, it was that we will maintain all clinical services that we provide today. In a very considered fashion, dealing with Kentucky One, and it was a very intense competitive negotiation process because we also had another bidder, Health Management Associates out of Naples, Florida. As part of the competitive negotiation process, we said we will maintain all these services. We will work together to negotiate how best to do that. But that's the primary goal here. The Center for Women and Infants exists today, and it will exist tomorrow. And after the joint operating agreement is implemented, University Medical Center and its board will remain intact, and they will manage that part of the operation. Kentucky One Health will have no say in what goes on there.
Now, the employees working for University Medical Center for U of L Hospital, they will become Kentucky One employees, right?
With the exception of those employees who currently work on the Center for Women and Infants.
Now, how will that play out in terms of the care that they provide at University Hospital? Will they be under the directives of Kentucky One Health?
Well, Kentucky One Health was formed and has a faith-based tradition, not just with the Catholic Church, but also there's a Jewish heritage. And so Kentucky One Health asks caregivers who work in its facilities, and that will include the non-Center for Women and Infants part of UMC, to respect those traditions. And it's really that simple. They ask them to respect it.
So it sounds like they will fall under the conditions of Kentucky One Health.
And those conditions are such that Kentucky One Health has categorically stated it will follow all state and federal guidelines.
Will there be instances when a patient might be transferred to a Kentucky One facility that might be subjected to the care that you just described from the Center for Women and Infants?
If a patient is transferred to University Medical Center, the portion that would be a part of Kentucky One Health, and that patient requires an obstetrical procedure or a tubal ligation, that will be done in the Center for Women and Infants.
Now, I'm not a doctor, so I had to research this a little bit, but the drug methotrexate, which is commonly used to treat ectopic pregnancies, it's traditionally not been used in Catholic health directives. Will that still be in the clinics, and will that actually be in the hospital as well, or that would not?
We have been provided very strong assurances that first and foremost, the patient-physician relationship will be respected. Just as they ask us to respect their faith-based traditions, they acknowledge that the primacy of the patient-physician relationship remains in place. So physicians practicing in a Kentucky One facility would be able to use methotrexate and would be able to dispense it under those circumstances.
And they would actually have it in the facilities as well?
Yes, and if there were any issues related to that, which quite frankly I can't imagine exactly what they would be, but if there were issues, that's why we retained the Center for Women and Infants.
Do you anticipate employees to be cut during this process for some efficiencies to reduce the size in any of these facilities? Or will it actually grow because of these investments that you're making?
I think it's the latter, but it's too soon to tell at this point because we're just in the process. We're in the initial phases of discussing the transition plan and how we lead up to implementation. What I specifically said when asked that question the other day at our press conference was I think it's likely that individuals will retain their jobs but be redeployed into new positions if anything like that happens.
Now, is the hospital actually owned by the taxpayers of Kentucky or is it still owned in an independent entity?
Interesting question. My belief is that UMC is a public asset. And the land upon which it is built is Commonwealth land managed by the U of L. So they pay us a land lease every month, and we'll continue to do that through the joint operating agreement.
Was that discussed during the process, and what's Kentucky One Health's perspective on that?
Because of what the governor and the attorney general told us, it's openly acknowledged that UMC has a public trust mission and is a public asset.
You were telling me earlier this week about a report that you you had during the negotiating process that showed that the first few years of these investments will actually get a pretty good return. I was wondering if you can kind of explain that report, where you got that report from, and what that report shows.
Cain Brothers, who are investment bankers in New York City, provided us with that information. They developed a very, very detailed financial pro forma for this transaction. And as part of that, they looked at what are called contract finances. So that's money that's guaranteed, the amount of upfront money in the first several years, and also contingent finances. Based upon that, that's how we get our $1.4 billion figure. If you actually added all the numbers up that could occur, it's over $2 billion. But we used that, and then they told us that based upon a very, very conservative figure, that they thought we would be making money in 3 to 4 years.
And just quickly, in maybe 20 seconds, when do you anticipate seeing actual programs or actual upgrades happen? I know March 1st is the date that the latest date that this partnership will take place, but when will we actually start to see things? And again, just in a few seconds.
I think we'll see things by mid to late 2013.
And what kind of things might those be?
Consolidation of programs, upgrades, perhaps a cardiac intensive care unit at Jewish Hospital, the upgrades we already talked about in the Center for Women and Infants.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Appreciate being here.
Thanks to Dr. David Dunn, Vice President for Health Affairs at the University of Louisville, and WFPL's Devin Katayama. Coming up, Joseph Lord poses the question, who has the bigger bragging rights to the Abraham Lincoln legacy, Kentucky or Illinois? He's been asking around, and we'll have the answer to that coming up after the break. This is Byline on WFPL. Welcome back to Byline on WFPL. I'm Rick Howlett. The nationwide opening this weekend of the film Lincoln, starring Daniel Day-Lewis, is expected to reinvigorate interest in the 16th president's life and send droves of new Lincoln files to historic sites dedicated to preserving his memory. As WFPL's Joseph Lord reports, there are Lincoln memorials spread throughout the nation, but two states make the biggest deal out of him: his birthplace, Kentucky, and Illinois, where he launched his law career and where he is buried.
This raises the question, which state has a better claim to Lincoln's legacy? Gary Ferguson is a park guide for the Lincoln Birthplace National Historic Park near Hodgenville, Kentucky.
Well, I think here at the birthplace, you know, one of the things that I really consider here is where the foundations of the morals and of Lincoln is really, you know, instilled in him through his family, through the church that the family attends. It's really here where his ideals on slavery are put in place. So it's really the beginning of what he will develop into later on as not only a lawyer, but also when he becomes president.
Ferguson says it's important to remember that Kentucky is the only state where Lincoln lived where slavery was legal. And it's believed that some of the Lincoln's neighbors owned slaves. In fact, slavery is one of the reasons Lincoln's moved north. Lincoln's father was an uneducated but skilled laborer. He couldn't compete in an economy that included slavery. James Cornelius is the collections curator for the Lincoln Presidential Library and Museum in Springfield, Illinois. Cornelius agrees that Kentucky, and Indiana, played a big role in who Lincoln would become. But, he argues, if you put the question to the man himself, Lincoln would pick Illinois as the home to his legacy.
Because Springfield is the only place that Abraham Lincoln ever chose to live completely of his own volition, and that he chose to stay, and that he chose to marry, and chose to have four children there, and build his life as a small businessman and a small politician and then a big politician, that it is rightfully the home of Lincoln history.
There's an important distinction between the two states Lincoln cites. Lincoln was born on one farm near Hodgenville and spent several years on another, but the log cabin at the historic park is a replica. In Springfield, the historic sites are actually where Lincoln lived and worked, his home, his law office, the old state capitol where he was a legislator. It's also where he's buried. Matthew Pinsker, a history professor at Dickinson College who's written about Lincoln's life, says that's important for people looking to learn about Lincoln.
I have to side with Illinois. Abraham Lincoln is from Kentucky, and the state certainly was important in his life. And you can explain a lot about Lincoln's attitudes by reminding people that he's a white Southerner. But Illinois was central to his story, and his rise there is the central dynamic that made him a great politician and a great president.
That said, Pinsker says there's nothing like being in the places where Lincoln walked, be it in Kentucky, Indiana, or Illinois. If you're truly inspired to learn about Lincoln, you might have to see them all. Joseph Lord, WFPL News.
And you can find out more about the Lincoln legacy everywhere and the new Lincoln film at our website, WFPL.org. Well, nearly 2 weeks ago, Bruce Springsteen and the E Street Band performed at the KFC Yum Center, their first stop here in Louisville in about a decade. They're touring in support of Springsteen's Wrecking Ball album. There is also a new Springsteen biography out this month, and it has shot to number 4 on the New York Times bestseller nonfiction list. Author Peter Ames Carlin says he was granted unprecedented access to Springsteen, his family members, friends, and bandmates for the book, which is simply titled Bruce. It chronicles Springsteen's humble beginnings in New Jersey, his ascent to stardom, and his personal, professional, and artistic struggles. I spoke with Peter Ames Carlin about the book. I've always been curious about how Springsteen got the nickname The Boss, and had read somewhere years ago that he didn't exactly embrace it. You get right to that question in the prologue of your book.
Well, you know, one of the little-known secrets is that that's a nickname that Bruce came up with for himself, because he used to, you know, he hung out with his musician friends in Asbury Park, as you know, when they were all in their late teens and 20s, and they were like a little rat pack of you know, scroungy hippie musicians living on the Jersey Shore, and they played these weekly Monopoly games where it was kind of a new evolution in the game, where they made up their own community chess cards, and there was a lot of cheating and a lot of scheming and a lot of rapping back and forth, and Bruce tended to win these games because he was so shiftily charismatic and bribed people with candy, essentially. That was his big secret. So they started calling him the Gut Bomb King, you know, because all he ate was junk food, and he was constantly handing it off to people to get them to team up with him. But he didn't like that, so he came back with Boss. They picked up on that and began using it, and they all sort of intended it to be a private thing between their tight circle of friends, but then some reporter like me, only different and a long time ago, leaked it, heard it, and put it in his story, and it became public property since then, when he intended for it to be just a thing for his very close friends and people who worked for him to use.
And you've previously written biographies of Paul McCartney and Brian Wilson. What led you to Springsteen?
The same thing that led me to those guys, which is, you know, he was one of my, you know, favorite musicians and artists, and someone whose work I had followed for years and years. And so it was, when the time came to think about, well, what do I want to write about next? You know, who's left? Like, what is there that I really, really, you know, care about? Bruce was an obvious answer. Also, just, you know, to be able to get to know and hang out with these other cool guys that he's known throughout his life, not just musicians and famous people, but just, you know, the ordinary guys he grew up with and hung out with and to a great extent still hangs out with. So, you know, so the whole process became a real joy because I got to dig so deeply into the life of this guy who I had admired for so long and really, you know, come to terms with or get to understand, you know, where all that music came from.
Now, you say you had unprecedented access to Springsteen, you know, the bandmates, family members, et cetera. Did you get to just spend some time just hanging out with him and getting to know him?
Yeah. I mean, that's a part of the process. You know, there were times when we spoke, you know, on the record with the tape machine running and me with a big, you know, legal pad full of paper, full of questions. And those were good conversations that, you know, often got, you know, funny and jokey and you know, and intimate and intense. Other times we just go off and, you know, have some drinks or something, get some pizza, you know, or just drive around in his car for a little while. You know, he'd take me, you know, we'd be going from here to there around Monmouth County in New Jersey. So, yeah, you know, he's a very guarded guy in a lot of ways. He's very secretive in some ways just because that's how he's always been. You know, he carries his complexity and that little stream, you know, everyone has their darker sides. I mean, and he, you know, he carries those pretty close to, you know, his chest. I mean, you know, so you become very aware that there's a lot going on under the surface. And every so often, he'll, you know, I'd get a peek of what it was, you know, or we would talk about it.
Did you find out anything about him that really surprised you?
When his mom and dad, you know, who again were working poor, people didn't have a lot of money, after they were living in an apartment when they had Bruce, and that was, they could all fit in there, but when his younger sister was born, you know, just 14 months after he was born, they ended up moving back into his dad's parents' place, and the grandparents, for complicated reasons, just began to raise him as their own, and so when his mom finally had enough of that and, you know, and said, we've got to get our own place, Bruce was hugely traumatized because he felt, you know, as he told me, like he had been taken from his primary caregivers. So that was very, very hard for him in a lot of ways. And, you know, and that sort of primal experience, that sort of primal trauma is one of, you know, one of the things that has, you know, that floats around in his psyche that makes his music, makes him who he is and makes his music what it is. Other surprises, you know, I mean, one of the things I've heard from his friends, I mean, in the year and a half when I was working without, you know, getting any access at all, was that he's exactly who you think he is, which is true in a lot of ways, because, you know, and who I thought he was a complicated person with, you know, a very, very interesting and complicated story to tell. So, you know, so maybe the surprising thing is that that is exactly true.
Now, any understanding of him would, you'd have to understand a lot of the guys that he surrounded himself with, and you were able to talk to saxophonist Clarence Clements, who unfortunately passed away last year.
That was just about 2 or 3 months before Clarence died, and it was one of the, you know, very early in the process of interviewing the band members. Clarence was very enthusiastic about getting together and took a lot of pains to make sure that we came up with a good, you know, days that were going to work for both of us, and you know, and that they would be sooner than later, which obviously was quite fortunate since he passed just, you know, not very long after that. But, you know, I saw him. We spent, you know, parts of a couple days together. He's very, he was obviously hobbled by his most recent surgeries. And, but his eyes were bright and he was sharp as a tack and funny and smart and insightful and a little bitter about some things and, you know, maybe rightfully so. But, you know, the feeling was, the overarching feeling was just this incredible love and dedication that he had for Bruce, which of course went both ways. So, you know, Bruce was really knocked down to his knees when Clarence passed so suddenly in, you know, in June of last year.
And also, I've always been fascinated with Stephen Van Zandt, who really in some ways is kind of like the band leader of the E Street Band.
Yeah, he was sort of Bruce's consigliere, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, that's how he defines his role in Bruce's life. You know, he's the guy who, you know, isn't the guy in the spotlight, but is kind of secretly, not so secretly, running the show just behind him. I mean, not that Bruce doesn't have authority over and pays extremely close attention to everything happening around him. But Steve is the guy that I think he knows he can turn to straighten up, you know, all the loose ends and dot everyone's I's and make sure the T's are crossed musically. Make sure, you know, so Bruce can kind of let some of that go. And also just, you know, if he was trying to get a sound for a record or a song or something, you know, I think the two of them have this very hardwired understanding of each other. So as Steve says, you know, I know exactly how Bruce wants things to sound.
Now, Springsteen's been able to stay true to his, you know, blue-collar background while being enormously successful and rich beyond his dreams. Is that something he struggled with in the beginning when he really first started to take off?
Yeah. Well, you know, I mean, the thing is that Bruce is sort of divided between that dark, you know, the sort of complicated, emotionally complicated Springsteen family and his mother's family, you know, the Italians, recent immigrants, the Zarillis, and his mom and her sisters, they were just very, very upbeat, unsinkable, energetic people who worked really hard and loved to dance and have as much fun as they possibly could. So those were sort of the divide. And, you know, on the one hand, he wanted to get deep into this exploration of people's souls and the flaws in people's souls. On the other hand, you know, he wants to play Rosalita really loud in front of people and watch them dance and feel their energy beaming up at him, because that's when, you know, he feels the most alive. That energy force that comes at him over the footlights is what I think sustains him. You see a guy up there on stage who seems half the age of a 63-year-old.
So what does he think of the book?
He was very sweet about it. He, you know, we traded some, you know, he got to see it a little before it came out, and, you know, we were trading texts for a while, and, you know, and he was very warm and supportive and said that he really, you know, felt moved by it. So that was really nice to hear.
The name of the book is Bruce, of course, biography of Bruce Springsteen. The author is Peter Ames Carlin. Peter, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
And you can, you will be able to hear our interview with Peter Ames Carlin again, if you'd like, on our website at WFPL.org. Give us a little time to post it, but it will be up a little bit later. This is Byline on WFPL. Well, tomorrow at Lexington's Commonwealth Stadium, Joker Phillips will coach his last home game as head football coach at the University of Kentucky. Phillips was fired 2 weeks ago by athletic director Mitch Barnhart, but will coach UK for its final two games, tomorrow against Samford, and then the following Saturday at Tennessee. Kentucky is 1-9 overall, 0-7 in the Southeastern Conference in Phillips' third season, and the question now is who can come to Lexington and turn the program around. And joining us to talk about it are WDRB's Eric Crawford and Mark Story, who covers UK sports for the Lexington Herald Leader. Welcome to you both.
Thanks for having me on.
Hey, Mark, we'll start with you. We've heard a lot of names tossed around as possible coaching candidates. Any serious contenders rising to the top?
Well, that's the million-dollar question. Mitch Barnhart coaching searches tend to be held very close to the vest, so we would mostly be operating in the realm of speculation. The names, you know, that you hear a lot are Sonny Dykes, who was a former UK assistant who runs a very high-octane passing attack and is winning at Louisiana Tech. You know, you hear a lot about David Cutcliffe, who worked with Barnhart at Tennessee and has Duke Bowl eligible for the first time since 1994. You know, there's a whole lot of, you know, assistants and a lot of names that are being batted around, but, you know, and somebody may have a better source than me, but I don't think anybody really knows, to be honest.
Is it safe to say the one name that won't be considered is Bobby Petrino, formerly of Arkansas and U of L?
It doesn't look like it. Obviously, there's a whole lot of a lot of the fan passion is behind that, which to some degree I understand, because Kentucky football is can be an emotionally wrenching experience, and Petrino is clearly a great coach, but there's just all so much off the field baggage that comes with him, and the indication that I've gotten, which is, you know, basically just you know, sort of vibe, is that he's not being considered at this time.
Would a decision come before season's end, or you think Barnhart will wait till all the games are played?
I would anticipate that it will not come until the season actually ends. I think partially because just if you do it before that, it could become a distraction, not that they're playing for anything. But the other thing is, if you're pursuing people who have jobs, You don't want to be a distraction for their seasons. The only exception to that, I think, would be if they wind up hiring a guy who was not presently coaching.
So this seems like it was a tough decision for Barnhart, even though the program was really struggling, for Barnhart to fire Joker, who's a friend of his.
Yeah, it was. I mean, it was emotionally difficult that Joker and Mitch Barnhart are genuinely close on a personal level. And the other thing is, I think Mitch probably deep down doesn't think what the problem here was necessarily the coaching, that they had some things that went wrong that were sort of outside the control of, you know, just they had a lot of things go wrong that maybe weren't directly attributable to the coaching. And I think his fervent hope, both probably out of friendship, but also just because he didn't want to go through another coaching search, was that Joker would do enough this year that they could, you know, hold him over. And I think it wouldn't have taken that much for them to do that. I think if they'd given him really any sign of hope at all, they did not want to make the decision that was ultimately made.
Well, I guess the Vanderbilt game with 18,000 fans now were in the stands for that. I guess that that will give it a sense of urgency.
Yeah, there was just no choice. In my column, I had tried to hold out as long as I could with Joker, but you know, everybody that was at that game, and just, I mean, the team, they played horrible. It was an embarrassing performance on the field, and there was nobody there. I mean, it was. I've never seen it like that in Commonwealth Stadium. And then from that point, I mean, even Joker knew. You could tell he knew in his post game news conference that, I mean, there was just no choice at that point.
And he seems to have handled all this with a lot of class.
Yeah, he really has, and that's something that probably we should go out of our way in the media to comment on more. He's handled this, what has just been a horribly negative situation, and he's a guy who's from the state of Kentucky and, you know, played at UK and has been in that program for more than two decades of his adult life. So it had to be incredibly painful, but at least his public face has been about as classy and about as dignified in a negative situation as I've ever seen.
Eric Crawford, at the far end of the spectrum, we have UofL football. Even though the Cards experienced their first loss of the season at Syracuse, they have two games left against Connecticut and Rutgers. I don't think anyone expected a national title this year from the Cards, but they still have a chance to get into a high-profile bowl.
They do, and it's the advantage, at least for this year and one more year, of playing in the Big East Conference, that you can do that and still have a BCS bowl looming out in front of you. The big question about Louisville is that was such a convincing loss. They were beaten so badly at Syracuse, it leaves everybody wondering, you know, where is this team really, and how is it going to play these last two games?
I went to Charlie, I don't know if you were there Monday, to Charlie Strong's briefing. He seemed visibly irritated.
He was visibly angry. You could tell it as soon as he came in, and it's not really changed for much of the week from what I've heard around the complex.
So I haven't scouted Connecticut, but that looks like that could go in the W column for Louisville.
Well, yeah, possibly. Both these last two games are games they could win, teams they can beat. They have a lot of offensive talent. Connecticut's a very good defensive team, and they will challenge Louisville's offense maybe more than anybody else has yet this season. Offensively, I don't know that they're as good as the Syracuse team that just beat Louisville, and that's Louisville's problem is on defense. So that's probably a good thing for Louisville.
So Louisville idled this weekend, and then they'll get back to it at the Papa John's Cardinal Stadium the following weekend.
That's right. There are still more than 1,000 tickets left for their last home game, which is hard to believe with a team that's only had one loss. It's a traditional problem at Louisville, but then they finish up at Rutgers in a game probably for all the marbles in the Big East.
Before we run out of time, Mark, let's talk a little bit of basketball. UK off to a bit of a rocky start. Coach John Calipari had, of course, downplayed the team's preseason number 3 ranking. They barely got by Maryland, but they seem to show some improvement, even though they lost to Duke last Tuesday.
Yeah, actually, I thought they were overranked in the preseason. I've been encouraged. They're actually farther along and I think they are going to be better than I actually thought they would be this year. Now, they have one area that, you know, clearly they're going to have to upgrade or need to work out, and that's the point guard play. Ryan Harrow, who was, you know, the presumptive point guard, is battling a mysterious illness and is not, you know, didn't play very much against Maryland and didn't play at all against Duke. Assuming that, you know, he comes back or they figure out the point guard, I think I didn't think this would be a Final Four year, but after two games, I now think they at least have a viable chance. They're very long and they're talented.
And you mentioned Ryan Harrow and this mystery illness, still up in the air as to what that is. I think they were waiting for some lab results, weren't they?
Yeah, they just have described it as an energy depleting illness, and that sounds bad, whatever it is.
And Eric, here in Louisville, no problems in the first two games for the Cards against Manhattan and Samford. Not exactly powerhouses, but U of L's looking good. They could face some high-level competition next week down in the Bahamas, right?
Expect to. They could play if they win a couple games, the same Duke team that just beat Kentucky. It hasn't been a really challenging set of teams to open with, unlike Kentucky's had. So I don't think Rick Pitino has as clear a picture of what he needs to work on. And I think there's some concern on his part that he hasn't seen exactly what he wants to see from these guys, and the learning curve is going to, you know, increase significantly here in about a week.
So when do UK and U of L square off in basketball? Is it last week of December?
Yeah, last December 29th, I believe, is the date on that, and it should be a great matchup because as I watch Kentucky, I can just see the matchups against Louisville. They appear to be two teams that match up extremely well against each other. Good big men, great athletic wings. It's going to be a very interesting game.
And just a few seconds left, Eric. IU, the number one team, looking very strong in the early going.
Extremely good. They're so good offensively. There's not anybody I've seen yet that can score the way they can score. So that makes them tough.
Thanks to Eric Crawford, WDRB and WDRB.com, and Mark Story of the Lexington Herald Leader for joining us to talk sports. Thanks, gentlemen.
Thank you.
We'll be back with more in a moment. This is Byline on WFPL. Welcome back to Byline. I'm Rick Howlett. Well, the holiday season is upon us, a time when our thoughts turn to how thankful we are for family and friends, peace and goodwill, and the official Red Ryder Carbine Action 200-shot range model air rifle with a compass and this thing that tells time built right into the stock, as Erin Keene says in her review of A Christmas Story, that last reference, of course, from Gene Shepard's classic story. The stage adaptation of that holiday classic is being produced for the final time this season at Actors Theater of Louisville. And in our art segment today, Erin Keene talks with actress Jessica Wortham, who plays Ralphie's mother.
Hi, Jesse. Welcome home to Louisville.
I know. It's so great to be back.
So you were born and raised here in town?
Yeah. Born and raised. Went to college in Danville and then graduate school in Rhode Island. And then moved to New York in 2005. So haven't actually lived in the city since 2001.
Wow. But your work here with Actors brings you back pretty frequently.
It's so nice because my whole family's still here and I still have friends here. So it's always a treat to get to come back and work in the city that you're from.
Yeah. So you've been, this is your third season playing the character of the mother in A Christmas Story at Actors Theater. And it's also the final year.
I know. It's so bittersweet. It really is because, you know, we've been doing it, well, the core members, the Justin, who plays the old man, my husband, and then Gabe Weibel, who is plays our son, Randy. We've all done it for the last 3 years. Justin and Gabe have done it all 4 years and just had their 100th performance of it yesterday,
Whoa. Which
is mind-blowing. But what's been so lovely about it is that I feel like it is a little family. And because Gabe is of that age where he's been doing it from the time he was, you know, 5 to 9, I've gotten to see him grow up and our relationship develop as he's gotten older, and also not just as a person, but also as an actor. And now that he's 9, he's getting it. He's making choices in the moment, and that's super exciting because most of my scenes include him. So he's my major acting partner. So that's been an adventure.
I've noticed that, actually, that, like, I remember the very first year that I saw it, it was like, He was 5.
Yeah,
and
he was
so young and so, you know, like he could do the lines and he was charming and he was cute. But like this year it was like, wow, he is really but he's still so tiny. So he still really works in the role. But like you can tell that he's an actor now. And
that's
really exciting to see.
Yeah. And like some, you know, he'll change it up night to night, too, which he always gives me something, especially in the first scene, the crazy breakfast scene, getting him, you know, getting all the kids out of the door.
Will you do the line for us?
The
piggy.
Oh, the piggy. Randy, how does a little piggy go? How does a little piggy go? How does a little piggy go? That's right. Now show me how the little piggies eat. Go on, show me. Oh, that's a good piggy.
So what is that like, creating a character on stage that the majority of your audience knows from, you know, really from a frozen text, from film?
It's interesting because the stage adaptation, you actually get a lot more of the parents in the stage adaptation than you do with film. With film, it's the, with the film, I think it's very much directed through, you know, an 8-year-old, 9-year-old Ralphie's eyes.
Yeah, there's a gaze with the camera that really directs that.
Exactly. Yeah. And you're not, and because it's a son, I would say that the gaze is more focused on the father than it is the mother. The mother's kind of just always in the background making things happen. Outside of like the soap scene, the soap poisoning scene, and getting Randy out of a cabinet. In the film, she's not, I don't feel like she is as present, you know. But on the stage, in the stage production of it, she's on there a lot, and you get to see the parents interact a lot, even without the kids, which you don't really get to see in the movie except in the very last scene. So the challenge for me was, how do I take what are these iconic in the film, those two main scenes that I remember from the film, because I haven't seen the film in a long time, are the soap scene with her and then, you know, dealing with Randy in the morning. How do I take what that little nut is, which is probably the core of the character, and then make choices from that and expand it out into something fun and engaging?
Yeah. It does. It seems like, I mean, because when people are so, and especially because A Christmas Story is one of those movies that people rewatch over and over again and really get to know, that as for folks who are doing a stage adaptation, is it ever, I mean, do you ever feel that tension like between, am I just imitating the scene in the movie, or like, so how do you really develop your own character while not disappointing the people who are coming there expecting to see the how does the piggy eat scene?
That's a good question. So I think the trick is with the show is that people come in and they know the lines.
They whisper them.
Oh, they will say them before you do. That's seriously. I mean, that's more. I think the old man has more of those lines, with, you know, like Fragile and Major Award and, you know, all that sort of stuff. I feel like it's less so for my character. But what's fun about doing it in the moment and on stage is that it kind of changes a little bit every night based on what you're given from the audience. There really is a play between the energy that the audience is giving you from, you know, from the audience. You can feel it on stage. So the exciting thing then becomes, okay, we're all in this together. And as you can slowly read the audience and what they're responding to up to that point, you can kind of, meet out, if that makes sense, what they're going to respond well to in the moment. And, I think that's the trick with it. At the same time, it's like they're already there, and since they know this, since they're there and they know the show, they're ready to laugh.
Yeah.
So they're kind of ready, I feel like, to see what's to hear what's familiar, but see something else.
Okay.
Do you know what I mean?
Like, Randy's, you want a surprise. You don't want to feel like you just watched somebody act out the movie on stage.
Exactly. Right. And like, you know, Gabe will do different things with the oatmeal every night, so I never kind of know what's gonna. Is it going to be all over his face? Is it going to be all over the floor? Is it going to be in the milk glass? So there's
opening,
a lot of...
Yeah, on opening night, he had it all in his hands, and people were like, ew.
Yeah. Yesterday, he just grabbed a bunch out of Ralphie's bowl and threw it on the table. And I was like, oh, okay, that's what we're doing today. All right. So, you know, it's kind of fluid. You have the basic structure, which everybody knows, but I think the fun of it is seeing how do you do it live in a space and still, you know, you can let go of what you've seen in the movie because the lines are there. I think people are more attached to the lines in a way than necessarily the imagery from the movie outside of the lamp. I mean, you know.
The lamp.
Outside of the lamp.
Because it's a series of, I mean, the story is really a series of vignettes. I mean, the plot, as it were, is boy, wait, you know, counts down 2 weeks to Christmas and really wants a gun. Like, that's...
Yeah. And then for the mom, though, see that's great, because that's, like, the story from the 8-year-old Ralphie's perspective. And from my perspective, it's 2 weeks of seeing her son, Ralphie, kind of grow into a man, in a way. And not a man, right. You know. But in the stage adaptation, there's a little... You get more of his... He has a... There's a love interest for him with Esther Jane, which... I don't think is really in the movie.
No, that's a stage addition. So what does that add to the story then?
Well, I think what it does is it gives the story, I think, more dimensions. So you have Ralphie, I mean, you know, he wants a gun, which a gun is like, you know, something you get when you become a man, right?
Yeah.
You get a gun when you're a man.
Yeah.
So he wants the gun. So that's kind of like his little early burgeoning manhood. And then he's kind of getting relentlessly teased by his you know, guy friends, his little guy friends about Esther Jane's looking at you. So I think you get a fuller life. And then he has, like, finally sticks up for himself and takes on Scott Farkas, you know, the bully. And then Esther Jane comes over to bring him back his glasses and talks about the gift that he gave her. And it's, I think what you do is you kind of get a more fleshed out, fuller story mm-hmm. of the life that's being lived outside of just strictly sort of like Christmas and what I want for Christmas and what I got to do to get it.
Right. It's more of a coming of age story than a series of sight gags and funny jokes.
Yeah. And Steel, we have a new Ralphie this year.
Right.
And you know, that's another thing. Doing it year after year, when we have new Ralphies or new cast members, they always bring something new to the table. And being able to respond to that always changes. You know, we have a structure to the play,
yeah.
but there's a lot of freedom within that structure. And having a new actor always is going to introduce a new element, because he's going to have a different line reading of something than, say, Henry from last year.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm going to respond to how he delivers the line as opposed to, you know,
yeah,
so by rote.
So that kind of helps you keep the character fresh year after year, too, when you bring it back.
Yeah, and you're able to develop little moments, especially now that Gabe's getting older. He's developed this sense of comedic timing, and he's
very funny now.
Yeah.
I mean, before it was like, I'm not sure if he was deliberately funny or he's just a silly kid, but now he's really funny on purpose.
Yeah, I think before it was more like we built things for him to be funny, like, because comedy is so much about, you know, it's really a lot about math and timing and rhythm and pitch, which, you know, a six-year-old is difficult to do with, but if you can give it to him and give him, you know, wait two beats before you say this,
mm-hmm.
and then it'll get a laugh rather than, you know. But this year, I don't know that he could actually put words to it, but now it's kind of, it's almost like the rhythm of that work for the past few years has kind of ingrained itself in his brain in a way, and he's understanding that now, and he'll just try something that is immediately funny because I think he's
like, he gets the math and he's giving you the equation now.
Exactly.
Wow.
Exactly. He's understanding that if he does something, it's going to give me something to react to, which in turn is going to get a big laugh.
Great. Well, yeah. Jessica, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks,
A Christmas Story. This is the last year for it. You can see it through November 25th at Actors Theater of Louisville.
And that's WFPL's Aaron Keene talking with Jessica Wortham, the actress who plays the mother in A Christmas Story. And Aaron's review of that production is at WFPL.org. And Aaron Keene is here right now with us. Hi, Aaron.
Hi, Rick.
We have a few minutes left in the program, and you want to talk about another Actors Theater production that is underway called True West.
Yeah, this is a Sam Shepard play about two brothers, and they're kind of opposites. Austin is an Ivy League educated screenwriter, and Lee is a drifter who steals TVs. So diametrically opposite brothers who end up in their mother's house while Austin is house sitting while she's on vacation, and things sort of unravel very quickly for both of them. It's directed by Adam Rapp, who is a playwright and a director, and Actors Theater audiences have seen his work at the Humana Festival before. 2011 was his last play there, The Edge of Our Bodies. And Adam, I think, was a really good choice for director for this show because his own work is really brutal and unflinching. And so he really takes this Sam Shepard play. And Sam Shepard is a kind of a brutal, honest, unflinching playwright. And he really just goes full bore with it. The brothers start physically fighting kind of midway through the play. And so it's set in the Bingham Theater, and they've put up plexiglass walls, which work really well live.
Mm-hmm.
Because then they just start slamming each other around. And this means that there's no splatter or shove zone in the first two rows of the Bingham. And it means that the actors don't really have to hold back. So it's a very brutal play, but it's darkly funny also. And it's surprising when you are used to reading a play or you've seen filmed productions of it to see what a live audience laughs at, too, because some of this stuff...
Mm-hmm.
It's not really funny. I mean, we're talking about deeply entrenched family dysfunction and alcoholism, which has actually been like an interesting through thread so far in this season at Actors Theater.
Now, this has been referred to as Bear Pit Theater.
So I've interviewed Adam Rapp before, and one thing that I've noticed is that the Bear Pit is a favorite metaphor of his for live theater, or the live theater that he particularly leans towards. So that's, I think, a really apt image to say, like, what are you getting when you go see an Adam Rapp play, whether he's the director or the playwright? And if he has his way, what you're doing is you're watching a Bear Pit fight. like either metaphorically or perhaps even literally. So this play opens tensely, and the tension just mounts and mounts and mounts until the end, where you think actually somebody might die on stage.
And True West has opened at the Bingham Theater and runs until when?
It runs until December 9th.
All right. WFPL's Arts and Humanities reporter Aaron Keene, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Rick.
That's all the time we have for today's program. For more information about topics discussed on Byline, visit our website, WFPL.org. Byline is produced by the WFPL News staff, our production team led by Laura Ellis and Brad Yost. I'm Rick Howlett. Have a great weekend.